May it please the court. My name is Edward C. Hopkins, Jr. I am the counsel for the plaintiff and appellant, Michelle Fry. My number is 43298. If this court affirms the district court's ruling, it will give our trial courts at least one new power. It will give them the power to rely on evidence outside the pleadings to determine disputed facts concerning how reasonable and ordinary readers interpret ambiguous words or phrases that are susceptible of both innocent and libelous meanings. The Supreme Court in Nat v. Post, 144 P. 2nd, 981, explained that jurors should determine in what sense words were used in cases like these, not judges. And in Bustos v. A&E, 646 F. 3rd, 762, the court explained that deciding the materiality of a statement, false statement, often requires a jury. The defendants published two articles about Ms. Fry on March 15 and 16, 2011. The first article was published on the internet as a breaking news story. Its headline alleged Ms. Fry was caught up in plagiarism charge. Both articles contained the verb phrase, ripped verbatim. It was used to describe Ms. Fry's actions. Both articles alleged Ms. Fry had admitted to plagiarizing. The first article did not specify who charged Ms. Fry with plagiarism, nor did it explain what a plagiarism charge is. And neither article defined the word plagiarism for the reader, leading the reader to determine what it meant on his or her own, based upon the context of the article and that reader's common knowledge.
Counsel, excuse me for interrupting. Are you aware of any case anywhere in the United States, that any appellate case, that where the court held that the use of the word plagiarize or plagiarism was defamatory?
I am aware of a case, but it was cited in a very old treatise that I do not have with me.
And I assume not cited in the briefs.
It was not cited in the brief, and it was not a Colorado case.
Thank you.
Ms. Fry's First Amendment complaint alleged the two publications contained several materially false and derogatory statements about her. The defendants published their articles to millions of reasonable and ordinary readers. These readers could have interpreted the articles in at least three different ways. Two of the interpretations are logically inconsistent with one another. Only one of the interpretations could make the article substantially true as a matter of law. The articles could be substantially true as a matter of law if and only if all reasonable readers and all reasonable jurors interpret plagiarism as an act that does not require intent. The articles would be materially false and libelous if reasonable and ordinary readers and jurors interpret the word plagiarism as an act that does require an intent to pass off another's work as one's own.
Pardon me, counsel, I'm confused by the intent issue. And I'm unclear as to what your contention is about what intent would need to be shown. Is your client saying that she didn't intend to copy something from one document into another, or is she saying that she didn't intend to pass it off as her own without attribution? And if it's the latter, isn't her intent belied by the fact that she didn't have a citation to the source in her document?
Your Honor, my client is trying to explain that she did not intend to pass off another's work as her own, and that she did not attempt to deceive anyone. She is making the intent to pass off another's work as one's own synonymous with a deceitful act. And that's why it is important and material, because someone who does not intend to pass off another's work as their own can make a mere mistake. That person can do it honestly.
Well, doesn't the term plagiarism include mistaken citation without without attribution. For example, you know, we've got the Vice President of the United States, Joe Biden. His presidential aspirations several years ago went down the tubes because he plagiarized. But I don't know that anybody had contended that he or anybody else had intentionally tried to pass off something as their own. So I'm having trouble understanding where your concept of intent comes from. Is there any legal background for that?
Sure.
For it?
Certainly. The Black's Law Dictionary describes it as requiring the intent to pass off another's work as one's own, the intentional act of deception.
Well, let me ask you about that, because I know that you don't in your First Amendment complaint, but in your briefs on appeal, you cite to Black's Law Dictionary, the definition of intent. And you actually say in your brief, you use the word that it requires intent. I don't see the word intent anywhere in Black's Dictionary. So where are you coming up with that?
Your Honor, the actual word intent is not in Black's Law Dictionary, but the definition which we cited in the brief is the deliberate and knowing presentation of another's person's original ideas of creative expressions as one's own. We infer from that that intent is entailed.
And do you have any authority that allows you to make that inference? I mean, knowing certainly doesn't imply intent.
Certainly, and I can understand Your Honor's argument. We do not have authority that would allow us to say that that inference and only that inference can be made when someone sees the word plagiarism. But we are contending that the reasonable and ordinary reader could interpret the word that way. And because that was a material question of fact that was disputed at the trial court, it should not have been accepted as true that the defendant's definition, which allows for the unintentional or intentional, or only the intentional, or I'm sorry, only the unintentional, should have been the definition that was used to create the reasonable and ordinary reader that the trial court used before it did its substantial truth defense analysis.
But isn't that what trial courts do all the time, whether it's an issue of statutory interpretation or an issue of contract interpretation? They have to figure out what the plain and ordinary meaning of words are, and they looked at things like dictionaries and cases. And so, I mean, how did the trial court get it wrong here when it looked at just a basic ordinary definition and then looked at the context of the words and made a legal determination that this is the way the average reader would interpret that? This is what they would think it meant.
Your Honor, we're contending that the trial court did two things. It made a factual determination about how reasonable and ordinary people use that word. Indeed, how it used the word and the phrases in the articles. So it didn't just stop at that determination. It used that determination to go on and do its legal analysis. But trial courts do ordinarily determine what words mean. But in instances where there are disputes about how reasonable people would define or use those terms, those are the types of disputes, according to Nat V. Post and according to Bustos, should be given to the jury. So the jury can determine in what sense the words or the phrases were used. In an innocent sense, like the defendant's claim, or in a libelous sense, such as Ms. Fry's claim, because she did claim that most or some reasonable readers interpret plagiarism as requiring the intent to deceive. And she did that in her allegations 52 and 53 in her First Amendment complaint.
But isn't that just simply a legal conclusion rather than a factual statement that you're making in your First Amendment complaint? I mean, that's nothing more than just saying this is how the law ought to be.
I understand, Your Honor. What I think we are trying to help the trial court and this court differentiate between is the definition of the word and how reasonable people use and perceive it. Now, how it is defined in Merriam-Webster's or any dictionary, there could be hundreds that could define it differently. How it is defined is something that can help the court can use to help determine what it meant if there's no dispute. But when there are material disputes about whether or not definitions could be logically inconsistent, as there were in this case, our definition is logically inconsistent with the definition that the defendants offer. So when there is logical inconsistency among reasonable definitions for the same word and phrases, the court must back off and give jurors the power to determine what reasonable readers interpreted those words and phrases to mean. That is the argument that we're making. And that is what we believe the court did wrong. It violated, in our opinion, Rule 12b-5, and it invaded the province of the jury by determining what reasonable people think without giving jurors an opportunity to hear evidence, to understand context, to hear depositions. Nothing. There could have been reasonable jurors who, like Your Honor said, could perceive plagiarism to be intentional or unintentional. Those type of jurors would have to add an adjective to their form of plagiarism. And they would look to the context of the article to determine whether or not it was being alleged that this person intentionally plagiarized or unintentionally plagiarized. In this particular case, they have a lot of material to work with. They have the verb phrase rip verbatim. All other things remaining equal, rip verbatim is going to tip the scales in favor of intentional plagiarism. They also had the concept of charge, caught up. These are things that people often, if not usually, hear in the context of criminal charges.
Let me interrupt you again, and I apologize, counsel.
The problem.
Why would anybody interpret this as implying a criminal charge? There was nothing in the article that talked about any kind of criminal activity, prosecutors looking at this. Why would anybody, any average reader, have come to that conclusion?
Reasonably.
I understand. Well, the average reader had a lot of gaps. The story didn't fill those gaps.
The story said that it was the Denver Post who was essentially charging her. You had this reporter calling her up and saying, "We've got a problem here. What's your response?" I mean, it seems to me, just reading the articles, it's crystal clear where that charge is coming from, as it often does in these cases. It's coming from the media.
Your Honor, we agree with you that some reasonable people, some of the millions of reasonable readers, could have interpreted it that way. We also argue that some of those millions could have interpreted differently. They could have interpreted that the Denver Post was speaking on behalf of someone else.
Such as, well, all right, let's follow that through. In terms of your allegation is that they could have inferred that she did something criminal and had been charged with that. Where would they come up with? Who is the person that the Denver Post would be speaking on behalf of?
That was left unsaid and unclarified in the article. It was omitted. And keep in mind, the Denver Post tells that its readership is greater than the number of people who are estimated to live in the state, which would lead to a logical inference that there are people outside of the state, perhaps outside of this nation, who read those articles, who might have different laws in their jurisdictions, who could have interpreted in a way the way Ms. Fry played.
So is that really an injury to your client if somebody in Kuwait reads it that way?
Perhaps not in Kuwait, but we would assume that that is something that a juror would get to decide, because a juror doesn't know what Ms. Fry's career plans are. If Ms. Fry plans to take, for instance, an independent contractor job with a defense contractor in Kuwait, that might be something that would prevent her from getting the job. But those types of possibilities are exactly the types of questions of fact that made it a type of situation that was not beyond doubt. The trial court could have and should have had doubts as to how reasonable people would have interpreted these words and phrases and whether or not those would have been defamatory. Your Honor, I would like to reserve the last 1.5 minutes I have, or a little less than that, for rebuttal.
Yes, you may. You can lower the podium, counsel. There's an arrow right below on the right-hand side.
Thanks. Thank you, Your Honor.
You're welcome. I have that same issue myself.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Steven Zansberg, bar number 26634, and I represent the appellees Curtis Lee and the Denver Post. The trial court did not err, as some of the questions from the panel has indicated, in doing what trial courts do routinely in construing language in challenge publications, whether it be a contract, an ordinance, statute, here published articles that were not disputed, and in determining what those words placed into issue by the complaint would be understood by a reasonable reader, and that that's what courts do all the time, and that it is done as a matter of law, and it is done based upon an objective test of what a reasonable reader would understand, and through consultation of ordinary dictionary definitions, here including dictionaries that were cited in the complaint. The trial court decided, based upon the pleaded allegations, those that were factual in nature, not legal conclusions, and the contents of the two articles, including the headline, that the defendant had failed, I'm sorry, the plaintiff had failed to state a claim for defamation because there was no material falsity. The plaintiff did not contest that she had plagiarized in the commonly understood meaning of the word plagiarize, which is to present the ideas or words of another as one's own. And it is, as Your Honor has pointed out, not a necessary condition that that be done intentionally, as with former Vice President Joe Biden. Copying text from another source and presenting it as your own is plagiarism. And that is what, and that is the only thing that the Denver Post stated that Ms. Fry had done.
Well, let's talk about the presenting it as your own part of the sentence that you just indicated. Is that, is there some intent that's brought in that piece of it?
No, and not necessarily, unless it is stated to have been done intentionally. Nothing in the Denver Post article stated that Ms. Fry had done so intentionally. It used the word plagiarism four times in the first of the two articles, and contrary to what counsel has stated, it did include a definition of plagiarism in the text of the article, and most importantly, in the context of the article. The court construes the term in its overall context and how it was used. And the article explained that when first contacted, and this is undisputed, Ms. Fry denied having copied any text and presented it as her own. Whether intentionally or unintentionally, she absolutely categorically denied that she had done that.
I'm looking for that in the article. I have the article up on the screen, counsel. Can you tell me where that is?
Yes. After seeing a side-by-side comparison that showed her responses were not her original work and did not cite the proper source, she recanted. In the context of this sentence, the reader is told that Ms. Fry originally denied ever plagiarizing. And then it says, but when she was confronted with a side-by-side comparison of her original work and it did not cite the proper source, she recanted. In other words, she admitted plagiarizing. And then it goes on in the next sentence and explains that she explained that she had done so inadvertently and she apologized. She would never intentionally lift. And so the only logical explanation, the only logical connotation a reader can take from this article as a whole is that Ms. Fry admitted that she had copied another, had presented original work that did not cite the proper source. It does not accuse her of admitting to have done so intentionally. To the contrary, it immediately thereafter explains that she did so unintentionally. There's no allegation, no reasonable interpretation of the word plagiarism as used throughout this article as suggesting intentional failure to attribute. And as Your Honor pointed out, there are two elements of plagiarism. One is copying another's texts and presenting it as your own. There's no dispute that that occurred. There can be no dispute that that occurred. And the Denver Post made available for its readers the side-by-side comparison that had a longer side-by-side comparison and attached to our motion to dismiss that the judge considered as well. It was undisputed that she had intentionally copied blocks of text from the National League of Cities brochure that is, as I said, was linked to from the Denver Post website so that readers could see for themselves. And Ms. Fry initially denied having done so, but then when confronted with that side-by-side comparison, had no choice but to admit that she had done so. And in fact, if you look carefully at the CD page 64, question one of her response, and CD page 62, question six of her response, and compare that to the National League of Cities publication at page 71 in the record, you'll see that actually she did make some minor changes, changing the word your community to our community, thereby further making it clear she was using the text of another as her own. So it was admitted that she was doing that. The Denver Post story contains no allegation that she had intentionally failed to cite the National League of Cities source, and immediately after explaining what plagiarism means, included her explanation that she had done so inadvertently.
So is the real question here, in the context of this case, the issue of attribution? In other words, if she had used these exact words that were from the text that she took it from, and then cited to that text, we wouldn't be standing here, right?
It wouldn't be plagiarism, exactly. If one cites the text of another and gives attribution to it, that is not plagiarism. And she would not have been accused of plagiarism in the Denver Post article, and she would not have admitted to plagiarism in the Denver Post article. That's the crux. The counsel suggests that plagiarism, that the court invaded the province of the jury by deciding whether or not the statement had an innocent connotation. Plagiarism is not an innocent connotation. Joe Biden had to step out of the presidential race because he was accused and admitted to plagiarism, even inadvertent plagiarism. It is defamatory to say somebody plagiarized. It does lower one's standing and reputation in the community. No one is arguing that it's not capable of a defamatory meaning. It is, but it's also true. And if it's true, it cannot be actionable as defamation. And that's what the court held, is that the allegation leveled by the Denver Post article was that Ms. Fry had copied other texts and presented it as her own, and that she explained that she had done so inadvertently. And therefore, the Denver Post article was substantially true. It wasn't capable of carrying the particular defamatory allegation the plaintiff ascribes to it, which was that it necessarily accused her of intentionally, deliberately, in the Black's Law Dictionary, doing so.
Which is, I take it, why, I mean, there's a little bit of carryover here in terms of the framework for the legal analysis. In order to get to the issue of substantial truth, on not just the use of the word plagiarism, but a lot of these words that are being challenged here, doesn't the court in the first instance have to figure out, well, what's the meaning that I'm going to attach to these words? And then I can figure out whether it was substantially true or not. So there's a double edge to that, seems to me, to that legal analysis. Am I missing something, or is that correct?
No, you're absolutely correct. The court looks at all of the words placed in issue and determines whether or not, putting aside the labels and the legal conclusions that the plaintiff may ascribe to them, and that is the Denver Post v. Ritter case, the court treats all factual allegations as true, but as in Walker versus Lymingham, the court can also disregard factual allegations that are plainly refuted by evidence the court can consider as part of judicial notice, etc. But the court construes the language of the publications as a whole in context, both headlines and the published undisputed text, and determines what a reasonable reader would understand those words to mean in that overall context, and then determines whether or not, in contrast to the admitted facts, there's any material falsity. And all of the phrases that were challenged, charges, caught up in charges, As the court has noted, as we've briefed, there is no crime of plagiarism. There isn't any other mention of any criminal proceeding whatsoever. Charges are commonly understood as referring to scandal, controversy, accusation, not criminal in nature. In fact, the plaintiff admits in paragraph 49 of the First Amendment complaint that had the word scandal or controversy been used instead, it wouldn't have been defamatory in her estimation. But there isn't any reasonable reader, the court concluded, who would understand this article taken as a whole as accusing Ms. Frye of having committed any crime. There simply isn't a crime of plagiarism, and there isn't any discussion of any crime, criminal activity whatsoever. That other challenged words were recanted, the words plagiarism, I've already explained that Ms. Frye did recant her earlier denial of having plagiarized in any way, meaning having copied another text and represented it as her own. That's what recanted means in the context of this article as a whole, that she withdrew her earlier denial of having plagiarized, having presented another's views, other's words as her own. The last and newly challenged, not challenged below, phrase ripped verbatim, and in the reply brief for the first time, plaintiff suggests that ripped verbatim is the straw that breaks the camel's back, whereas one additional bit of evidence and ripped necessarily means ripped off, and that connotes intentional thievery and wrongdoing. Again, ripped means to copy, and it was admitted by Ms. Frye, as she must, that she did rip this text verbatim. It was copied verbatim from the National League of Cities brochure. In fact, she was quoted in the story, as her email to Mr. Frye said, that she would never intentionally lift material from another source. So lift, rip, there is, again, no material falsity by what was stated by the Denver Post. In sum, the Ms. Frye did acknowledge and admit, as she must, to have intentionally copied the text from another source and to have failed to attribute it. She did not admit to intentionally failing to attribute it. And the Denver Post didn't accuse her of doing so. And no reasonable reader could construe the article in as a whole, looking at all of the challenged words in their context as carrying that connotation. And that's what Judge Mullins ruled. And again, it is the ordinary course, and courts applying Colorado defamation law have done this repeatedly as a matter of law in looking at uncontested text. Counsel cited the Bustos case from the Tenth Circuit that for the proposition that defamatory meaning and connotation of words placed in issue can frequently be or should be in many cases subjected to a jury. In that case, it was decided as a matter of law that an allegation that the plaintiff was a member of a prison gang was not materially false because of the evidence that showed he was engaged in a conspiracy with that prison gang. This court in the Gruber case, which we is in the record at pages 123 through 128, on a motion to dismiss, a 12b5 motion sustained, a court's determining that no reasonable reader could understand an article as supporting the claimed defamatory connotation that the plaintiff had poisoned squirrels because what was published is that he had fed squirrels. Again and again, at pages 11 and 12 of our brief, we've cited numerous authorities that this is what courts do all the time. And because the plaintiff did not adequately plead material falsity, none of the ancillary claims that were pleaded as well could go forward consistent with the First Amendment. Truthful statements cannot be the basis of any tort claim. Unless the courts have any additional questions for me, I urge the court to affirm the trial court's ruling below.
Thank you, counsel. Rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. What's different with this case from the other cases that Mr. Zansberg has cited in his brief is that we are dealing with logically inconsistent proposed definitions. That's just one step of it. The other step is we're dealing with something deeper. We're dealing with the minds of the readers, millions of readers. The trial court decided what millions of people thought about these articles, how they interpreted it, dismissing the possibility that reasonable people could interpret it in different ways, dismissing the possibility that there are hundreds of thousands of reasonable people out there who believe that plagiarism requires an intentional act to deceive, dismissing that altogether. That is the problem that happened at the trial court. Logically inconsistent, disputed definitions that could not be taken on judicial notice because they were disputed. Disputed from different sources based upon how reasonable people use those words. Ms. Fry pled that plagiarism required intent. Their motion, which was not a pleading, which is something outside of the pleading, introduced new definitions. The trial court did not give other reasonable people's interpretations of that article an opportunity to be heard. Instead, the trial court relied on its own creation of reasonable person, and that reasonable person could not have interpreted, according to the trial court, the articles as being libelous.
Thank you, counsel. Your time has expired. Thank you to both counsel for your briefing and your arguments. We appreciate them very much. The case will stand submitted, and you will receive a written opinion in due course.